Blog Talk Radio.
This land is mine. God gave this land to me. This brave and ancient land to me. And when the morning sun reveals her hills and plains, then I see a land where children can run free. So take my hand and walk this land with me, and walk this lovely land with me. When you are by my side, with the help of God, I know I can be strong.
Well, good evening and welcome to another happy Shabbat. This time next week, many of us will be celebrating Pesach. So this time next week, it'll be a Pesach show. Kirk, JB, how are you, fellas?
Good. Hey, JB.
I'm sure you guys heard the good news. The Ebola outbreak in the Congo is not yet a global emergency. I'm sure that makes you feel much more comfortable this evening. Yes, and we also have news that really, really upset me. Assange, who I consider a hero, I think that Assange and Edward Snowden are amongst two of the most courageous and wise men of our age. And I know a lot of people have a differing view. They buy into the government's line that they compromised American security, and I'm here to tell you that's just not the case. What they did is they embarrassed America, and that's why America wants to go after them. The cables from the State Department and the War Department that they released, and they began with releasing the U.S. Apache helicopter gunship that killed some 20 Iraqi civilians in cold blood, just gunned them down. And America was, of course, denying it. And so WikiLeaks, and that is, by the way, the issue that he's being, Julian Assange is being extradited on right now, is that he proved that we did exactly that. And we killed several Reuters reporters, women, children. You know, just gun them down with our Apache gunships. And then lie about it, because that's what we do. And he went on to expose all of the commentary that was going behind the scenes, which has said the same thing about the Iraqi war and the Afghanistan war that I've said before we invaded, that these are winless affairs. There's just absolutely no reason to be sacrificing American lives and coin. We made a bad situation worse in these places. And then he was embarrassed America because our State Department is really snippy. We say just disgusting things, even about our allies.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Childish things. It's just children. But these are children being paid by the taxpayers to have little potty mouths. And so he exposed them. He was instrumental in causing those of us who knew this was the case but didn't have the evidence to validate it. Like, for example, it's Assange that released the cables that showed that America was the instigator behind the Syrian war. We started it.
Absolutely. I remember.
Deliberately, in fact, you did the research on it, deliberately, purposely, undeniably America is the reason for the Syrian war, and then we go and blame Bashar al-Assad for it. You know, America is the reason. In fact, I've done the cables. America is the reason that there's upheaval in Ukraine. We instigated armed riots against the freely elected government. Then we go and blame Russia for it so we can justify the buildup of NATO. The fact is, what he disclosed is that America is despicable. It's exactly what God has to say of us in the 18th chapter of Yeshayah.
Yeah.
Well, Assange, if what I've read is true, and I don't spend a lot of time on this, so I may have this wrong, but I read in an article that Assange said something disparaging about the Prime Minister of Ecuador. Well, he's in the Ecuadorian embassy. If he did, that probably wasn't the smartest thing he could have done.
No.
So the Ecuadorian Prime Minister says, you know, it's a burden to have him there. We're just not going to have him there anymore. And I'm sure he elicited some bribe from the United States to let him go. And so the British Prime Minister went in and the government went in and seized him. And, of course, they went, in their parliaments and saying, you know, this horrible person now is under our control. You know what his crime was in England?
No. What?
Skipping bail, which he said he didn't do. But skipping bail on trumped-up charges, the United States falsified rape charges against him. The whole case has been completely dismissed. So if you're out on bail on a case that you know has been trumped up against you, with the whole purpose is to extradite you to another country that's going to take you to America, and they find out that you're right, that there is absolutely no validity to the case, wouldn't you think if you were a moral country, you drop whatever charges you had on him, skipping bail on charges that were invalid?
You would think so.
You'd think
you're
so.
A moral
but,
country.
But Britain does not. And so Julian Assange has been extradited, or will soon be extradited to the United States, and he'll stand trial for hacking into a government computer. You know what's interesting? The government plays by a different standard. If you are a whistleblower in a company, no matter how you get the information, you're protected and exonerated for being a whistleblower. But if you're a whistleblower against the despicable actions of the United States government, they're going to pursue you with the full extent of their legal system.
They can tap yours anytime they want. Sucker.
It's just so reprehensible. It's flat out irritating. But as they say, you get the government you deserve, and that's what we deserve here in America. Returning to Yeshayah, we were doing a recap of the 17th chapter of Yeshayah. We'd reached the 17th, the 7th statement in the 17th chapter. And we were finding out that on this occasion, the covenant's children will be removed from a vexing time of grief. And what appears to be the last possible moment, Yahweh is allowing his witnesses to remain and share his message with the world right up to the point that prolonging his children's stay would put his family in harm's way. Now, you might say that, how is he putting them in harm's way? We all have eternal life. We're all perfect in his eyes. Well, the overwhelming preponderance of those who are in the covenant, they read, they learn, they share with loved ones, but they're not actively engaged in promoting Yah's message. It's an extremely difficult thing to do. Most people have jobs. They have families they're responsible for. Have limited resources. And the attitude that's required to do this is pretty uncommon. You gotta want to be poked, badgered, beat up, harassed in every possible way. And you got to be willing to put yourself out there so that the majority of people are going to come to hate you. Not a lot of people signing up for that deal. because Moloch are designed to protect somebody who is simply a beneficiary of the covenant. Now, being a beneficiary of the covenant is a really good thing. And it takes a lot. I don't want to mean this at all. It takes a lot to be a beneficiary of the covenant. You've got to give up a lot. Now, you're gaining a billion times a billion times a billion times more than you give up, and everything you give up is worthless. Everything you gain is beyond comprehension valuable. But you give up a lot. You're going to lose family members. You're going to isolate yourself from friends and family and from the society. And you're going to spend a lot of time doing things that people do not understand, in fact, that they're opposed to. And you're going to accept terms and conditions that are completely contrary to everything you've ever been told. It takes a lot. And you can't do it based upon your translations, JP, or your translations, Kirk, or my translations. You've got to go the next step, which is why I was so keen to share that meeting that I had with the couple here a week or so ago, because every other statement he made, he could embody the truth. The truth had become part of him because there wasn't anything that he didn't check and verify. And the more he checked and the more he verified, the more he learned, the more the message became part of him. So it takes a lot. But it takes a lot more to put yourself out there to actually publish and promote translations of Yah's Word. And so, while there are certain individuals that are doing this such that they can claim the 91st Psalm as their protection, and they could go deep into the tribulation. For the most part, he really does need to bring his children home. And for the most part, very few people want to see what's coming. And we're going to talk about what's coming. It's horrific. But to hear it in words is one thing. To see the gore, the mass extinction of hundreds of millions and billions of people, and the vitriol that will be coming out of their mouths, and the lies that they will be promoting, it's going to be tough. I mean, it would be very difficult for anyone who knows and loves Yah to listen to what is going to happen, to see what's going to happen, and retain their cool so that they can be effective witnesses. God knows it. Best thing to do is pull his children out. Now, once he pulls his children out, he's not leaving the world without a witness, mind you. Mm-hmm. Because there are two witnesses that are going to be extraordinarily empowered. They're going to understand every language. They're going to be able to communicate in every language. They're going to know the Torah inside and out. And they're going to know the arguments foisted against the Torah inside and out. And we know that there will be a time when Moloch are actually going to raise Yahweh's Ten Statements and say, now these Sunday laws, all this Easter and Christmas and May Day and the like, 4th of July and Halloween. No. No, this is what I said, and I'm not changing it. It's interesting, too, that in that regard, the single most prevalent common denominator of the people, and I get it's anywhere from 4 to 6 a week now, that write and say, you know, I want to share the journey that I've been on over the past 2 years and become part of the covenant I'm celebrating the Mikra, is that the single most common thing is, how in the hell did we get to a Sunday religious service when Yahweh established the Shabbat? And there's not a single indication anywhere that he changed that. And second onto that is, people are a lot smarter on Paul than I was. It took me a long time to figure him out. Mm-hmm. And people, the number of people said, listen, I just knew Paul was wrong. And if Paul's wrong, Christianity's wrong. And if Christianity's wrong, boy, we need to look and figure out if anything is right.
What is right? Yeah.
Yeah, what is right? You know, in that regard, I began to do a lot of, not so much soul searching, but kind of external debating. In other words, projecting the idea that someone out there is coming upon this material and trying to ascertain whether or not it's true. And for way too many people, it comes down to, am I telling the truth or not?
Mm-hmm.
I wish it wasn't that case. But we'd be foolish if we didn't recognize that. That is the thing that most people say. So I was there talking to the guy that's the premier marketing individual in the country when it comes to talk radio and television talk programming. He called me today and he was telling me about his conversation with the guy that has either the second or third largest audience. And this is the fellow I did an interview with, and he's saying, you know, he's trying to find out why this individual didn't post a 3-hour show on his page for his subscriber base. And I've been communicating this to him all the time. He's not going to do it. And he never was going to do it. At least I thought the odds were 20-1 against.
Agreed.
Because he has people paying him a lot of money
mm-hmm.
that are comprised highly of the same kinds of people that you'd find listening to Alex Jones or on Coast to Coast.
Yeah.
Where probably half favor conspiracies. Half would be religious, or not half, but I would say, because you can embrace more than one of these. So half would more than half favoring conspiracies, more than half being religious, more than half being political. And this message is hostile to all of that. And to put somebody on that is this blunt, this caustic to the audience's beliefs, it's tough to do. Because you're going to have huge segments of that audience that I'm not paying for this anymore. And in your terrestrial radio, you're going to have advertisers that are going to respond to complaints. And on the other show, you're going to just lose subscribers. So there are not a lot of people that are willing to do that. I mean, it's one thing to say you're going to give up your free time, you're going to give up your earning power, and you're going to devote yourself to this. It's another thing entirely to say, I'm going to risk my
livelihood. Yeah.
Yeah. And so we were talking about that, and he said, you know, this particular fellow said, you know, it's one way or the other with this guy. He's either the single most important voice in the world today, because what he's saying is profoundly important, and it's about the single most important issue in the world, and nobody else saying it. Or he's really a kook. And there's really nothing in between, is what he said. And as you know, the hardest thing is that he completely condemns Paul. He says, which, you know, more than two-thirds of my audience believe was inspired by God. And so I was listening to this, and I didn't say anything, because what's the purpose? I'd say there's no benefit, because I don't think the guy's going to air the show, because it's too hard on his audience. This is one that was just no holes barred. I mean, this was right in your face. Far more aggressive on anti-conspiracy, anti-Paul, anti-religion, anti-patriotism, anti-war than I would typically be on terrestrial radio. And I then realized that, you know, of the 1,000 most important insights that we've celebrated here over the past 18 years,
mm-hmm.
90% of them are irrefutable. The fact that there is no renewed covenant. It's not debatable, it's irrefutable. The fact that Paul was a false prophet, not debatable, it's irrefutable. The fact that Paul condemned the Torah, not the Talmud, it's not debatable, it's irrefutable. The fact that Paul was demon-possessed, irrefutable. That the covenant is the single most important thing from God's perspective, irrefutable. That God never did away with the Mikra, irrefutable. That the chosen people remain Yehuda and Yisrael, irrefutable. That the set-apart spirit is feminine. That the most important things to God are set apart, they're not holy. And all the implications of that, that Yahweh's name is Yahweh, that the Torah is not law. That there's three destinations for human souls. There are 1,000 of them.
Mm-hmm.
900 of them are irrefutable. And it leaves maybe 100 of them that are subject to interpretation. I can't tell you for certain that Yosef fulfilled Pesach in 33 CE. Could have been 31, 32. 34, 35, I can tell you that 33 is the only date that fits in terms of the eyewitness accounts. But I can't. I wasn't there.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody marked it down on the calendar. You know, if you do the math, every indication is that Dode laid the cornerstone of the temple in 968 BCE. 1,000 years earlier, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
That's what the historical record
is. But you got the Nobel.
So, you can look at the dates. I can't deduce that it was exactly 1968 BCE that Abraham and Yitzhak were on Mount Moriah. But it's based upon the testimony in the Torah, it's within a handful of years at that time.
It's a high likelihood.
Yeah, I think that if you put it all together, you know, I can't prove that the flood occurred exactly 5,000 years ago. But, you know, the Burkle Impact Crater and the testimony sure indicate that that's when it occurred. And so there are things that, you know, could be off for year two, three. Possible. And so there are things that you have to extrapolate. But if 900 of the 1,000 most important insights that completely undermine patriotism and politics and religion and emphasize the Mikra and the Bereth, Yahweh's name, his Torah teaching, the validity of Dode and his prophets, his nature, his family, then what does it even matter?
Doesn't.
Yeah.
It really doesn't, does it?
Hmm.
Now, in the big picture of things, if we embrace the covenant as in Abraham, then Yahweh is duty-bound to ascribe the benefits to us, regardless if he returns in 2032 or 2033 or 2034. And whether that Teruah harvest happens on Teruah in 2026, 27, 28, 29. There are lots of little things that we have learned throughout this process that resonate. They're consistent with the whole story. They seem to be affirmed in every possible way. For example, Yeshayah 17 provides a timeline of events. That timeline of events points right to these dates. There are so many other testimonies about a generation not passing away before all of these things are fulfilled that reaffirm it from every possible angle. And so I don't think there's anything that we're talking about now that doesn't resonate, that isn't consistent with the overall story. But even on those things, we've had to extrapolate. When you compare them to the whole cloth of what we have learned that is irrefutable,
or not to trust,
you're irrelevant.
Yeah. And we have certainly, you know, when Diallo says he's pulling his witnesses, harvesting us at this time, you know, we're going to leave this legacy. Diallo's going to lift it up.
Wow.
And there'll be lots of people that say horrible things about me and about us and about it. But it's been the case all along. You know, I shared something two shows ago, or a show ago, I don't know if it was one or two, that I had done something relative to my son's trust, where over the last 30 years and most recently I probably was on my, I'm a flawed individual, but there's certain things I've done that were every step of the way I've done the right thing for the right reason, and this was it. And for one son, I got a very favorable reaction, and the other one, I got a negative reaction. And I shared that. And the kind of the pain of knowing you did the right thing and you got a negative reaction. And then I think you guys, I'm sure you both know that we had the conspiratorial types are raising their ugly head again. And I guess they're losing their adherence or can't attract an audience or whatever, and they're looking for a fight. And they used my family to really twisting of these stories, which turned out to be really good because I got so many letters over these past 2 weeks. People in the government saying the same thing happened to me. I'm in the same situation. And we're able to share, which is just hugely important. So no one feels alone. And what I came to realize, because I'm translating right now the most interesting passages I think I've come across in years, which is the story of Sodom and of Lot and of his daughters and of Moab that grew out of it. And what I realize is that Sodom is Moab, and Moab is modern man. And what I came to realize is that Lot is Israel. At times brilliant, at times staggeringly corrupt. But what Lot represents is the fractured family of man. You know, there's a reason that the second codicil of that first requirement of the prerequisite, if you will, the covenant, is to walk away from Babel, your country, and that'd be the Babel of religion and politics, and then from your father's house, the family of man. Family values, human family values are really corrupt. They were on display in Sodom. And so, through that story, what we're learning is that the human family is fractured. And the more you understand how badly it's fractured, the better, and how our own families, you know, probably 90% of us have division in our families. You said it would be so. Yeah, I always said it would be so. Is that the comparison all the way through that story is the covenant family versus man's family. God wants us to understand why he's not going to allow man's family to be extinct and to be extant and during Sukkah in his home, why he had to wipe them out. And sometimes having, for all of us, frustrations, aches and pains, disappointment, fracturing in our own families puts us in a much better position to understand God from his point of view. I remember right after I read this, one of these horrible letters, somebody that wrote at the level of an eighth grader, promoting conspiracies and then degrading me, that they this time they tried to dredge up stuff to condemn my interactions with my family. And I went to God and I said, hey, no, God, that's not what we agreed to. Remember the agreement on Prophet of Doom that, and team with terrorists, if I engage in this, my family be protected? But I went to God and said, wait a minute, this was not our deal. What's up with this? He said, I promise to protect your family from the very thing you asked me to protect them from. Islamic jihadists. I did a pretty good job, didn't I? No one was ever threatened. You never saw one show up at your home or ever threaten you personally, did you? That was my promise. I honored my promise. Why should your family, though, be treated any different than mine? My family is attacked and assailed every day. I've done nothing but good for them. And yet they demean me and attack me every single day. How in the world are you going to understand why I write and have the things to say that I have to say if you don't have some of the same experiences?
Yeah.
And you hear that and you say, yeah, you're right. Gives us character. It gives us perspective. It helps us understand. JB, what'd you say?
I said it's just one more way for us to be able to relate with Yahweh.
Exactly.
Agreed.
And there's nothing we can do that is better than seeing things from his perspective. I was having lunch with a friend today, and I was talking about the mistakes. I was just highlighting some of the mistakes I'd made over the years. And one of my mistakes was I always looked at, until maybe 5 years ago, I looked at Yom Kippurim as the reconciling of our relationship with Yahweh. You know, I made all of the mikra were personal to me. But that's not what it is at all. The Yom Kippur doesn't have a thing to do with me, with you, Kirk, or with you, JB. Nothing.
Well, I mean, we're going to be a witness to it.
Yeah.
We're going to be a witness to it. We're going to be better than a witness to it. We're going to get to celebrate it. But not as participants in it. As children of the one who's going to be having the best time at the party. What I found is that Yom Kippurim didn't have anything to do with us. It's about Yahweh reconciling his relationship with Yisrael and Yehudah. And that doesn't take a thing away from any one of the three of us. Because when you get to share the joy of someone as extraordinary as Yahweh, who has done as much for us as Yahweh, when he reconciles his relationship with Yisrael and Yehudah, and we're there as witnesses, second to him, we're probably going to be more excited about this than even the beneficiaries of it. So when we embrace Yahweh's point of view, rather than being diminished by it by depriving us of our own point of view, we gain something that is tremendously valuable, far better than what we could ever have otherwise. And I think that is the way we ought to be looking at lots of things, and that was the lesson I got this week on fractured families.
Mm-hmm.
So it says, in that specific day, this man, so now these are those, there's 7,000 people, and I know when I say that, lots of folks who are really dear to me said, you know, we think that might be a lot. But it would be consistent with what everything else Yahweh has said, which is 1 in 1,000,000. 7,000 would be 1 in 1,000,000, with 7 billion people being on the planet. And so I don't think he gave those numbers to be haphazard. I think those numbers are precise, and I think it follows his model all the way through. And, you know, I get 2 or 3 letters a week, and each letter now involves more than one person who is coming to celebrate the Mikra and the Covenant. And so I'm personally convinced we're going to get there. I think we're going to have that many people that respond. And what God is saying is that the thing that's going to be the most extraordinary for us at that time, in that specific day, is this individual will actually gaze upon, genuinely regard, and actually accept, both trusting and properly responding, so as to receive an ongoing gift which makes him acceptable to the Almighty, the one who engaged and acted to get this done. own volition, to continually look, considering, finding delight in, while developing an understanding toward God, the set-apart one of Israel. Our focus is going to be on him. And it's going to be an extraordinary moment in time. And we're going to get to be face-to-face. What a thrill. I mean, guys, you guys are terrific. But,
yeah.
You know, first moments with you, you ain't going to be looking at me, and I ain't going to be looking at you.
No.
That's what this says. That'll be our first experience. So then, he shall never accept. What's the second thing God said? All right, the moment our focus is entirely on Yahweh, guess what? We will never again accept, nor gaze upon. We're not going to regard or trust, we'll never favorably consider, and we'll forsake the altars and religious sites, these works of his hands, representing what his fingers have made. Now, in this particular case, I don't think Yahweh was talking about us per se. I think he's talking about his children. Mm-hmm. And the more articles that we read about the archaeology that's going on in Israel right now is what they're constantly digging up. It's two things. One is absolute proof that the historicity of the Torah prophets themselves is precisely accurate. That people by those names lived, cities by those names existed, and the details that Yah provided are all validated, including that Israel worshipped Baal, the Lord, and had idols to them, to false gods. And so it's Israel that has made false gods. And it's Israel that made the false god of Christianity. Paul. It's Israel that made the false god of Allah, Muhammad. And the Talmud readings that the rabbi sold to Muhammad to create the Quran. It's Israel that created socialist secular humanism.
Yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's, of course, Israel that created Judaism. And so the race most responsible for creating religious artifacts, including those that existed during this time that Yahshua was writing, is Israel. And he's saying that's one thing, that when they finally get it, that Yahweh is God, all of that religious rubbish they were part of will no longer be part of their vocabulary, their interests, none of it. They won't even consider it anymore. Now, I think that most of us have to continue to consider it right up to that moment. And then there'll be two witnesses that have to consider it right to the end. And Yahweh will have to consider it right to the very end, because it has to be exposed, condemned, and obliterated. And God's not obliterating man's religious and political myths and those who host them, embody them, embrace them, without explaining to them why they're being annihilated or why they're being incarcerated. But for Israel that has been so religious and idolatrous and so responsible for man's religious all the time, that's the one thing that they're going to do is realize that, well, we're never going to do that again. So this says, so then he shall never accept or gaze upon, nor regard, nor trust, nor really ever favorably consider, and will forsake the altars and religious sites, those works of his hands, representing what his fingers have made. The moment they're in God's presence, God is saying the single most relevant thing for you to understand is that there's no religion in my presence, and there's no vestige of religion still within those who are in my presence.
Right.
I think so, too.
Yeah.
But that's a profound thought. There will not be any vestige of religion. If somebody is religious, you are not welcome in God's presence. If somebody has a cross tattooed on them, you better get that thing off.
Yeah.
That's what this means. They will not focus upon, look to, nor consider, and they will not find pleasure in either that which is associated with the Asherahs, the mothers of gods, of the gods, the queens of heaven, the Madonnas with child, especially not the worship of sun god images, which are leavened, embittering, oppressive, cruel, and ruthless. Well, the two religions that favor the Asherahs, Christianity, Mother of God, Queen of Heaven, Madonna and Child, and Islam, with their overt worship of Asherah. And oh, by the way, the Christian says, oh my, I don't do that, that's Orthodox Christianity, that's the Roman Catholics. Well, that would be three-quarters of Christianity, mind you.
Yes.
But I would say, so this Sunday.
Easter doesn't count?
Yeah. It is named after.
Yeah.
Asherah, after all.
Ishtar.
Yeah.
Yeah. And they say, well, we don't worship the sun. The hell you don't. You know, what day is Easter?
Yeah.
It's a Sunday sunrise, right?
Yeah, sunrise service. Everybody goes
right there. Right there, the closest full moon to the vernal equinox, when the sun is in Taurus the Bull, which is when all pagans celebrated the conception of the son of the sun, who was born 9 months later on the winter solstice, Christmas. Tell me you don't worship the sun. What do you think your steeples are? What do you think your crosses are? What do you think your halos are? Well, that's not what they mean to me. Well, that sure is not what they mean.
You missed a memo. That's exactly what they mean.
Yeah.
You know, the golden calf didn't mean the golden, you know, wasn't a pagan symbol to the Jews, and you saw what happened to them.
Yeah, well, it had a circle between
them.
Yeah,
they worshipped it.
I mean,
they made a golden calf and said, let us go have a celebration to Yahweh. They thought they were honoring him with it.
Huh. Yeah,
it didn't
matter
what it meant
calf.
To them, it's what it meant to Yahweh.
Right, that's correct. Do you know the story of the golden calf, what it actually represents? The Pharaohs claimed to be gods, didn't they?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know the religious cult of the Pharaohs, what it was about? The Pharaohs, they called to be, they claimed to be sons of Ra and all that sort of thing. The Pharaohs had their own religion. Dominates their tombs. It's one of the things that very few people ever know and talk about, and yet it's essential to understand the story of the golden calf. Study sometime the Apis, A-P-I-S, bull cult among the pharaohs in Egypt. That was the god of the elite, the bull, Apis the bull. And if you look at the hieroglyphs of the bull, it always had a sun disk between its horns.
Yes.
That's exactly what the Israelites built. They built an idol that was worshipped by the very pharaohs that enslaved them.
Right. Kill them.
And God said, he ain't taking that shit into my home.
No.
And those of you who were stupid enough to do that, you're out of here. And it's one of the things we have to be really careful of, because God did, he wiped them all out. Just killed them all. And you might say, well, you know, we should be out there killing people who go onto religious sites with halos and crosses and steeples and worship on Sunday and Easter and Christmas and the like. No. There's a real difference between us and God besides the obvious. And that is that if you are the source of something, you can truncate it and still be totally and completely fair. You know, for example, Kirk, you're going to get some eye surgery here. You might be out of some work. And I could say, you know, while you're out, Kirk, I'm going to give you $1,000 a day. And,
wow.
And about 20 days into this, I'd say, Kirk, you're a great guy. But, you know, I'm not getting nearly as much out of this as I thought I was. And you don't seem to appreciate it as much as I thought you were. In fact, you're actually doing some things that are really hostile to me. I'm just not going to continue giving you $1,000 a day. I'm going to truncate my gift. Have I cheated you in any way?
Not at all.
All right. So, you know what? Conceived life, he gave mortal life to the people that he ended up wiping out. And he freed them. was contributing to them every day, and they decided they were going to turn on him. Did he deprive them of in any possible way when he said, then the life that I gave you and the freedom I gave you is now over?
No.
Goodbye.
No.
No.
Yeah, free will. He chose badly.
Right. Right. So Yahweh is in a position where he can truncate life without it actually taking anything away from someone. We can't. So we have no authority to do it. Those people who respond violently do not understand Yah's approach. Yah can do what he does because of who he is and what he created. And there are things, there are times when we can follow his example, and other times we just have to learn from it. You know, so for example, the fulfillment of Pesach. I can't follow it, I can learn from it. There's lots of things like that. This is one of them. And we're coming to a time where God's going to wipe out hundreds of millions of people, maybe even billions. But all he is doing is shortening the life that he gave them, truncating it. And he's truncating the life of people without any hope. And there are times when annihilating something is actually the single most merciful thing you can do.
Yeah,
you know, for example, if you, Patty, and your daughter were to live in the Congo, and a bunch of some 20 people with Ebola decided that they really liked your house and they were going to move in and live there with you, would you accept them?
No.
No, of course not. There are some deadly toxins that we have to isolate and eliminate for the safety and well-being of those we love. And so for Israel to continue to have hope, those who are violently or are deadly set against eliminating Israel have to go. They're not losing anything because they had no hope. Such that those who have hope might have it sustained. And that is what's happening at this time. And so it's vital that humankind comes to understand that this is a life and death distinction, which is the choice to be religious or to engage in the relationship. The earth has become miserable because religion and because of politics and because of militarism and all of those kinds of things. And if Yah allowed them into heaven, then heaven would be as corrupt as the earth.
No difference on earth.
To do it. Yeah. So the contrast is going to be palpable. Just as the world's most menacing religion, the faith founded upon disease, death, and destruction, intensifies its indoctrination of jihadists, inspiring them to believe that killing and pillaging are a service to their God, the Almighty is going to remove those who have chosen to trust Him from this religious battlefield. But at this time, there will be billions of Christians who are going to be left behind, wallowing blindly in all manner of Baal and Astarte, sun god imagery. The rapture they had anticipated occurred, but under a different name, on a different day, such that all of those who had disassociated themselves from their church could be part of the covenant that these Christians had thought they had replaced. But alas, this will be a small secondary harvest. Those who question the disappearance of as many as 7,000 souls, those who bring this to the attention of their religious and political leaders asking why it occurred will be, why it happened, why did this occur, will be misled by those who have crafted corruption into an art form. Now, collectively, these realizations underscore a stark truth. The religious are unable to process. If God allowed it to happen, eternity would be no different than what we're currently enduring. all of the grief, all of the perversions, all of the confusion, all of the conflicts, all of the pain, all of the suffering that religion has brought to the earth would be transferred to heaven, making eternal life miserable. And of course, is the high pitched voice of Asher, which is saying, "I want what I want now that I want it." I learned last night she does have a low voice. I got a remote controlled car and started buzzing it around, thinking she would chase after it because she wants to chase after everything. Oh, that scared her, so she went into her really low. I am rough. I am scary dog voice, but what you were just hearing there is. I want what I want because I want it. Yep. Now, those who are gleaned on this day will all have the covenant in common. Each will have walked away from Babel, from religion, from politics, from patriotism, and from militarism. Now, let me make this point clear. Everyone who is harvested on this day will have walked away from, if they were ever part of, conspiracy. We've reached a point in time where the single worst babble on the planet is no longer religion. It is no longer politics. It's no longer patriotism. It's no longer militarism. The worst form of babble of commingling truth and lies is conspiracy. And the people who advocate it are as, and I shouldn't say as, the people who promote it are more zealous about it, more passionate about it, believe in these conspiracies with a greater degree of faith than any religious zealot. The ultimate babble today is conspiracy, which is why in the prophetic testimony of Yahweh says, don't do it. And you got to be really careful, those of you who are still promoting conspiracy. Because when you can, if you go off and you believe in conspiracy, you know, World Trade Building 7 was an inside government job, that all of these mass shootings are a government plot where it's political actors and it didn't really happen and real people aren't dying. Chemtrails. That vaccines are a government plot. If you're promoting that, then you're really no different than somebody promoting religion. And it's a difference between, you know, there's a huge difference between most religious zealots, and that most religious zealots aren't out constantly hacking or hawking their religion. The conspirator types are so insecure that they're constantly trying to convince people that their conspiracies are true. So they're actively promoting it, which puts them on the wrong side of that equation of whether their souls are destroyed or they go into Sheol. But worse, we have now confronted a whole new breed of conspiratorial babblers because they're creating sites whose overall appeal is based on the transliterations and the terminology that we have derived here in these books and these shows. And they're drawing people in with that and claiming to be part of that while promoting their conspiracies. That's unforgivable. You know, these people claiming to be covenant who are doing that are far worse than those whose fate is to have their souls destroyed. This is an express ticket to Sheol. And I don't think there's any way of reasoning with them. They're far more impossible to reason with than our religious zealots, or those who are overtly political. And so that is what the world is rife with today. And it's truly a blend of those who are religious and conspiratorial and political. People believing the unbelievable.
Absolutely. Yeah, religious people, you know, they have their whole thing where they get together once a week and they all reinforce each other's faith by playing pretend together. Mm-hmm. Conspiracy theorists don't have that because even when you get them together, they can't agree half the time on the conspiracy. So they can't get that that affirmation from each other, so they have to go out and try and convince every single other person they meet that they're right.
Yeah, and beyond that, you know, I did the show not too long ago where I was saying the difference between today and yesteryear, and about that, I think that's how the 18th chapter of Yeshayahu begins, is that, and my commentary on it is that this is a different time where the average person worldwide is spending almost 7 hours a day online. Well, the people who are just feeding off of that are the conspiracy types. On average, they're spending more than 7 hours a day online, and all they're doing is trying to reinforce and promote their lies, their myths. And so it's far worse than the person who goes to church every other Sunday or plays make-believe with their finest clothes and says a few prayers and listens to a sermon and then goes off and plays golf. Mm-hmm. Be with the ladies. Mm-hmm. This is a lifestyle for these people. Self-defining. It's who they are. And it's become integrated into them because, as we found, the common denominator of those who are lured into conspiracy is that their lives are out of control, and that rather than taking personal responsibility for them, they seek to blame others. And the conspiracies all have others, government and Jews and whatever, managing plots that are somehow keeping them from succeeding, from gaining control over their lives. And I'm telling you, man, you have to think your way to the covenant. And one of its prerequisites is that you drop the Babel. And if you can't think your way out of that which is so utterly incomprehensible, irrational, there's no way you're going to think your way to God. You're just kidding yourselves.
I think for a lot of these people, the covenant is really just another conspiracy to them. It's one something they can point to and
right.
Say, oh, look, this was covered up. This conspiracy was true. Therefore, all conspiracies are true.
Yeah, they can actually create the conspiracy of the covenant, many of these sites.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's a really sad situation. They play at the lowest common denominator. Their attacks are all filled with rational flaws, and most of them focus on ad hominem arguments.
Yeah.
Collectively, these realizations underscore a stark truth that the religious just can't process.
That
the conspirators can't process. Now, this notion today is that all religions are spokes on a wheel and they lead to God, but I'm telling you that through centrifugal force, think about it. If there's spokes on the wheel, they're all leading away from it. They're all in different directions.
Yeah.
You know, those who are gleaned on this day will have the covenant common. They will all have walked away from the Babel of man. These descendants of Adams will be gathered together and invited home on this day to Ruah because they answered Yahweh's invitations to be called out and meet with him on Pesach, Matzah, Bukurim, Shavuah, walking away from their Heavenly Father and along the path he provided. Each are going to have these things in common because they're Torah observant. Now, I want to say something about being Torah observant because I think it's really important.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. If you're Torah observant because you're listening to these, if you're Torah observant because you listen to these shows, you're not. If you think you're Torah observant because you're you've read some of what I've written in these books, I'm sorry, you're not. If you think you're Torah observant because you're on a Facebook site with other people who claim to be covenant, sorry, it's not what Torah observant means. It means to closely examine and carefully consider. It requires us as individuals to do some investigating ourselves. to look at the words, to consider the meaning of the words, to closely examine the letters that comprise the words that comprise the sentences that comprise the paragraphs that comprise the teaching, and to ponder the implications of them in a logical and thoughtful and rational way, such that we come to understand. And I think that I've come to appreciate the process of transitioning from knowing to understanding reasonably well.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm here to tell you that that process requires engagement, action. It requires us to take what we are learning and to be actively involved with it such that we make connections and then respond based upon those connections. And just simply reading isn't enough. It's a head start, sure. You can read and learn and develop a foundation, but somewhere along the way, you got to do what you fellows have done. And what I think in the quiet period before the program today, Kirk, you told me how many people now that you're talking to who are translating Yah's testimony on their own, who need help with it, but who are trying to do it and who are doing the research to validate the truth for themselves. That's the key. A friend of mine was talking about her best friend who is Covenant, and that she has many of these books, and that she won't even show somebody the books, so they're so dog-eared and written on and everything else, because what she does is she studies the words and gleans additional insights from those words and then refers those the same words to other places where they're used to deepen our understanding. That's what it means to be Covenant. And by the way, on this day, JV, every man will be what?
Circumcised.
You got it. In that specific day.
My daughter walked in the room.
I know exactly what happened when I asked the question.
I beg your pardon.
I know what happened, and that's a good thing. In that specific day, it shall come to be that the cities of his refuge and his defensive fortifications shall be abandoned and deserted, consistent with an occult presence among the religious and merchants of death. And then the uppermost branch of the olives will be completely deserted for a time, released for having accomplished the goal of restoring the relationship that was damaged by the children of Israel. Then there will be appalling desolation and stupefying ruin. Even astonishing defoliation of trees and plant life, leaving those places ravaged and temporarily uninhabitable. This is not a pleasant picture. You know, this idea that God's going to come back and his arms are going to be outstretched and he's going to wear this beautiful white robe and he's going to have perfectly coiffed hair and isn't it going to be lovely and everybody's going to say hallelujah. That's not going to happen at all. He's coming back, and he's angry. Billions of people are going to be wiped out in an instant. And God actually, it's going to be kind of an interesting thing. There will be some people who are not covenant that will survive his return as slaves. And you might say, you know, why would God do that? It's all about recompense. You've got to make it right. You know, with the Holocaust survivors, now, there won't be any Holocaust survivors, but this experience that Israel's going to have at the end, it's going to be very equivalent to a Holocaust.
Mm-hmm. No.
And those who perpetrated it need to get a taste of what they did. And those that were the victims of it deserve recompense.
Sure.
Yeah. And there's going to be a period of time where, you know, the toilets will be cleaned by those who created a cesspool that were so destructive to Israel. So the cities and defensive fortifications that be abandoned, man's military bases and ability to fight is—it's just going to be deserted and abandoned. Now, if you're in the Air Force or the Navy, and you have witnessed the fact that it's a supernatural force that is wiping out hundreds of millions of people, you aren't going to sit there at your anti-aircraft gun or at your radar station and say, you know, I think I'm going to sit around this and I want to provoke him next. Let's go and give him hell. Maybe we'll shoot our Gatling gun at him.
Ooh,
don't think so. Yeah, hoorah. Let's send out a good sniper. Maybe we can nuke him.
Yeah.
Hoorah. Yeah, I'm telling you, they're just going to abandon their positions because American military might be powerful. It is like a pea shooter against a bazooka.
Yeah, well, Pharaoh thought he was pretty hot stuff, too.
Didn't he? The occult presence amongst the religious and the merchants of death, and then the uppermost branch of the Olives will be completely deserted for a time. In that period of time, there'll be no witnesses. I think that time's going to be very short. Because I think God's going to have multiple witnesses, the two that we know of, only one of whom's name we know, Elia. Elia, what an extraordinary individual. I love Elia. That's one of the best stories in the entirety of the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms. Elia with the Baal Peor. By the way, I want to apologize. Another one of my many mistakes. Baal Peor is not the Lord of Light. I made that mistake because of Or, being the Hebrew word for light. Well, it's not spelled the same way.
No.
Baal Peor is, Peor is the open and broad way.
The wide open way.
That is correct. He is the Lord of the wide open, or the broad and open way. The way that Yoshua said leads to death and destruction as he was condemning Pauline Christianity.
Yes.
And it's condemnation of the Torah. The broad and open way is Christianity. Baal Peor is the Lord of Christianity, the Lord God of Christianity. But if you read his story, Elia had a sense of humor. He said, maybe your God's napping. Maybe your God's out there in the latrine doing his business. I'll give you time. We don't want to hurry him.
That's
funny. Oh,
he's
hilarious.
Go ahead.
Oh, wait. I'm not in a hurry.
In the bathroom.
I'm going to be actually staying hostage right here any moment anyway, so you know, I got all the time in the world.
I was translating a passage from Elia last week, actually, and it was the way it was worded. I am a huge fan of sarcasm as a form of humor.
Yep.
And
yes.
It was like one of the most sarcastic responses. And I was like, wow. Like,
I'm going to tell you the single best job. The single best job in the world because of that, there's an unnamed messenger that, you know, was human just like Elia, but part of the covenant, that's going to return with Elia. We're not told his name. That job is going to be the coolest job in the universe.
Volunteering?
Just to be there with Elia. That'll be the coolest job in the universe. So, yeah, there's nobody that has a better time of it than he does. And if you don't have that sense of humor, there's no way you could be a witness to what's going on here.
No.
And not just be boiling over and seething. So it takes an Elia type that's got a sense of humor in all of this. Then there's going to be appalling desolation, stupefying ruin, defoliation. The trees plant life. Parts of the earth will become uninhabitable. You know, I don't know if it's chemical, biological weapons, atomic weapons. Who knows what it is, but it's just man is going to come within a whisper of destroying all life on this planet. That's just the bottom line here.
Another reason,
and particularly, our voice isn't very much, but it's collectively the presence of Yahweh set apart spirit and his malach and our voices, we're all going to be gone and all hell's going to break out loose. And then soldiers will be fleeing their posts, and then religious incantations and chemical agents will run amok. Israel's defense forces are going to fail. That said, there is also the possibility that his could be addressing Adam, and if so, mankind's population centers and military prowess, which have been become desolate and impotent and impotent, and such. This could be global carnage or carnage within Israel.
Mm-hmm.
I suspect it's probably both. I think that Israel is simply the, in this case, the canary in the mine.
Yeah, you build a strong case for both.
Yeah.
Because, yeah.
You know, the argument against the more pervasive option, however, is that Ha-Adam, the man being described, is now in heaven, having been rescued by the sacrificial lamb also. What follows of having forgotten your Savior, Yahweh introduced himself to the Israelites and his Torah and saved them from slavery and Egypt, the crucible of human oppression. So they have forgotten him, where Christians, Muslims, Hindus, and secular humanists have never known him,
mm-hmm.
and therefore could not have forgotten him. So I really do think this is, you can make a much stronger, more rational case that what we're talking about here is Israel rather than the whole world. The whole world's in a bad way, but Israel is what he's talking about.
Okay. Fair enough.
Does not mean, though, that these options are exclusive with one precluding the other. When more than one possibility exists, more times than not, God wants us to consider each of them. And so in this vein, the specific things excluded from heaven are more likely germane to Christianity than to Judaism. Christianity is more of a sun god religion than is Judaism, and thus to the U.S. and the EU rather than Israel. So from this perspective, the warning directed against America in the opening line of the next chapter of Yahshayah could simultaneously reflect parallel and sequential events. The United States has been complicit up to this point, having caused the Syrian war, having armed the Muslim combatants, and having led the parade to defend the promised land. Now, this prediction was once again prefaced by "in that day." So, this is going to happen in quick succession. The adherents are the most overtly occult popular religion in human history. Islam, and therefore Muslims, are going to pour into the promised land like a plague. The resulting devastation will be stupefying, leaving much of Israel deserted and uninhabitable. This, Yahweh reveals, will be endured because most Israelites have forgotten what he has done for them. They remain ignorant in part because they have chosen to favor the rabbinic Talmud over Yahweh's Torah teaching. And as a result of having rejected, the covenant's terms. So indeed, you have ignored and actually forgotten, becoming ignorant of, ceasing to care about, while improperly responding to the God of your salvation and your deliverance, and the rock of your protection and refuge. You do not remember or mention. By the way, if the God of your salvation is being spoken of people in the last days, it can't be Yahusha because they never accepted him, so they couldn't have forgotten him.
No.
Therefore, you know, and that's one of the things that is so profoundly important with, and I don't want to claim that that's everyone who is part of this program, and so I'm not projecting this on you guys, or that writes and translates Yah's words, that everybody agrees with this, but when I read in Mizmor 83, Dode in first person, telling the world that the purpose, the words written on the neck were him personally calling his family home. I realized that the very thing that's never going to happen with the Jews, the they're never going to embrace Yahusha. Ain't going to happen. They have been hunted around the world for killing Jesus, for killing the Christian God. They're not going to accept him. You know, they know there's no Jesus. They know there's no Christ. They're disgusted by the Christian God on a stick. Crucifixes, dead God on a stick. They know that the whole mythos of Christianity is based upon Dionysus and Bacchus and Osiris and the like. They're not accepting him. He ain't going to happen. But if the one calling them is actually Dode, who is central to their experience, central to Israel, it's for darn sure they can accept Dode. And Dode is going to lead them directly to Yahweh. And so they're going to accept the God of their salvation because they're going to be introduced to that God by the words that Dode scribed 3,000 years ago. Therefore, and this is why this is also important to look at the context. You plant a residence by pitching a tent for Adonis's vines and erect the Lord's dwellings, thereby establishing his residence, which represents the unfaithful home of religious misunderstanding, firmly embedding them into society, and you continually sow it, scattering this seed as illegitimate, unauthorized, and loathsome means to estrangement via vine and branch that needs to be pruned, a secondary wild and recent shoot, which is despicable and requires removal for its role in pagan religious worship. Who planted the garden on Moriah? On behalf of Yahweh. Dode.
Dode.
Yes. Absolutely. This is the alternative garden. This is the Lord's garden. You got Dode's garden, you got the Lord's garden.
Yeah.
And he's saying that the world is still fixated on the Lord's garden.
Well, look at Jerusalem.
Yes.
God, it's everywhere.
Yes.
Disgusting.
And so God said that you're still pitching the tent for Adonis, the Lord. He is the Lord's dwellings, embedding that. The unfaithful religious misunderstanding. You need to look at the garden that matters, the garden that's on Zion, the garden that is tended by Dode on behalf of Yahweh in that day. The plantings of your garden, all of which are arranged in order, the order that you established, will cause to grow and then carefully construct, you'll cause to grow and then carefully construct a barrier around them, controlling every aspect so as to turn oneself away through comparative resemblances. And in the early part of the day, when such things are considered, your seed will sprout, sending forth shoots which will be heaped up and held on the wrong side of the barrier, having wavered and wandered away from the harvest, and therefore left vexed and grieving. In that day there will be terminal disease and hopeless infirmity, affliction and tribulation, irredeemable wounds, and an inheritance of suffering which cannot be resolved, including the influence of incurable and incapacitating, completely irrecoverable mental anguish. Yeah, there's a consequence of planting weeds, pulling up the good plants, trying to replace God's olives with human apples. The real consequence of that. God planted a vineyard with Dode. And religious and people, political people, the conspiratorial people, want to remove what Yah and Dode planted, and to plant their own seeds, cultivate them, water them, arrange them, protect them from assault. And God says, yeah, you can protect them all you want. You're on the wrong side of the barrier. You can send out all those shoots that you want. send me a line to, you know, like my post. But you're on the wrong side of the barrier because you wandered away from the harvest. And you're going to be forever left vexed and grieving. In that day, there is no cure. There's no hope. There's no salvation. There's no recovery. We're not very far away from that time.
No. Maybe Newton.
No, it's time that we gave up the foolishness. Hey, you know, it was a really interesting thing. I was doing the translations of Lot, and you know, he is, and his daughters and his wife, you know, they hightailed it out of Sodom. Very reluctant, they hightailed it. They were very reluctant to leave it. And the Moloch were encouraging him to go to the mountain, which would be Moriah. And you know, Lot says, no, you know. I've obviously been honored by this, and I want to choose my own destination, and I don't want to go up there. That's just too much work. I'm not going up there. So, please, let me choose where I go. And you know where he went? You know the name of the town that he went to? Zor? What it means?
No.
Lowly and little.
Oh, yes. You read that. Yeah. There you go, Paolo.
Oh, yeah. Okay. They go lowly, lowly. And then he finally left it because he was too afraid to live there. And he went and lived in a cave. And then really, you know, living in Yah's presence on Moriah. Now he's living in a cave. And then he impregnates his daughters and they have children, and of course one is named Who's Your Father? And the other is Son of My Family. And of course those descendants go on to play a role in future prophecy because they are what grew out of Sodom. So there's a myth being actively promoted by hundreds of thousands of ultra-Orthodox Jews today, especially in Israel, that religious Jews are Torah observant. But according to Yahweh, this isn't true, nor is it consistent with the evidence. Orthodox Jews have made religion their profession, spending every waking hour obeying the laws rabbis have imposed on them. Their scripture is found in the Oral Law, in the Talmud, in the Mishnah, as minions. They thoughtlessly bob their heads while reciting rabbinical prayers from rote. There isn't one among them that knows Yahweh or follows his guidance. Worse, as a direct result, Jews have planted the seeds which have grown into Christianity, into Islam, and into socialist secular humanism, dominating our world today, corrupting our world today. Sadly, this is only the beginning of the bloodshed. They will endure as a result of their religious rebellion. The birth pangs are over, but now this is the onslaught of the worst of Jacob's troubles. But none of this should be seen as God judging the world. Based upon his own testimony, he is currently celebrating his time with his family. God's focus is elsewhere. Yahweh isn't orchestrating this affair nor micromanaging these events. He's simply going to allow all of this to occur. In fact, with the remaining Israelites, it's in their interest to have these appalling events progress to the point where they finally realize that they're incapable of stopping the horror they're experiencing, and to a great degree have brought on themselves. It's only then that a remnant will come to their senses and acknowledge that neither their nation, their religion, their intellect, their ingenuity, their wealth, their military can save them. That'll be the first step in the right direction. Acceptance of the first codicil of the covenant. Now, speaking of Israel's assailants, very few know, but it is nonetheless true, that if it were not for rabbis, Islam would not exist. According to the Hadith, and confirmed in the Quran, rabbis in Yathrib, today's Medina, sold Talmud stories to Muhammad, which he then incorporated into his Quran. Without these stories, the resulting book would have been too dark and depraved to fool anyone. and the fact that they changed, Muhammad changed them and charged them for what he used, and they charged a desperate man, a man desperate for credibility. You know, Muhammad was conspiratorial. And you undermine, you challenge somebody that is a conspirator, they'll go after you with everything.
Yeah.
It's below the belt. You know, Muhammad would order the murder of a mother nursing the child. He would disembowel his victims, would gloat at the carnage. It's what happens when you expose and make vulnerable a conspiracy advocate, as Muhammad was. And, you know, this is what Jews did. They sold Muhammad Talmud stories. They then exposed and laughed at him, mocked him for bastardizing them and pretending they came from Allah. And the consequence was the destruction of Jews throughout the Middle East and the ongoing jihad against Jews even today. And it's going to lead all the way up to the Magog War. It's what made Islam so anti-Semitic. Dumb move. There is also no disputing the fact that a Jew, a failed rabbi, no less, Shaul, who became Paul, the author of 13 Christian epistles and the subject of Acts, the father of Christianity, that he was a Jew. It's also overlooked that the first communists were found on a kibbutz in Israel. And an Israeli, Adam Weishaupt, was the author of Socialist Secular Humanism. Okay. Also telling.
Yeah.
I don't know what their role was, and maybe there is one in Hinduism. But in terms of all the other religions, they're it. In fact, they're even given credit by Joseph Smith for being the Latter-day Saints. According to Joseph Smith, a boatload of Jews sailed over from Israel, and a big boat came to the America, and they're the indigenous peoples, Jews. Now, of course, the DNA says exactly the opposite. But nonetheless, that's the myth. Blame the Jews.
Well, that's up a good myth.
Yeah, well, I make up a good myth. Yeah, bring in the Jews. Also telling, well, many hundreds of thousands of ultra-Orthodox Israelis are opposed to their nation's military and have fought politically to keep from having to serve in it. Others will perceive that the Israeli Defense Forces and the Israeli economic ingenuity are prevailing. Yeah, but it's going to crash and burn like Barbersheet. Did you see the sad news about Barbersheet this morning?
No.
Yeah, Barbersheet was the lunar lander that was created in Israel. They finally got it to the moon, and on its descent, the inertial measurement system failed. And it landed on the moon. A piece here, and a piece there, and a piece all over the place. Israel, though, has done a lot of marvelous things. The desert blooms. They've kept the enemy at bay. But those blossoms of hope are going to wither and fade away. Yahweh has affirmed that Israelites have been doing the work of the Lord, serving Satan, and they're going to be pruned. These discarded and short-lived twigs will be tossed aside because of the disease that is infecting them, and it's infectious, contagious, it's incurable. There are irreconcilable conflicts between the Torah and Talmud. And those Jews that you confront with this, they just bristle in anger. Well, that's not going to continue forever. So during what is almost assuredly the onslaught of the first phase of the Magog War, Mujahideen will flood into the land from all directions. But this time, the Israeli Defense Forces, unlike 74 and 68 and 48, not going to be able to stop them. Woe. Be wary of the preponderance of people of a great many nations, of those related by race, religion, and culture, with followers who will roar in hordes of agitated and confused terrorists, in multitudes of belligerent, flaunting their abundant wealth while clamoring emotionally with their worldly possessions in disorderly riots, agitated and enraged with the masses congregating along with their troops for a military purpose in a disturbing manner, similar to the loud groaning of stormy and confused, chaotic and surging seas of Gentiles who will choose to be driven by the winds of religious, political, and social desire. And then the corrupting roar of the destructive social chaos, the loud mocking cry as such things crash down and ruins around the huge, presumptuous clouds of rebellious and confused militant terrorists were panicked into fighting while wallowing in their depressed slime pit amidst the wasteful desolation associated with Sheol, of the antiquated people of these nations who are transformed while congregating under the inspiration of a religious and or political leader. They're going to be like the destructive and desolating uproar of a corrupting flood of those destined to the pit of Sheol, the dark and massive black hole which traps all light entering it forcefully. And a great number seeking fame and fortune, wickedly intertwined and thought to be extraordinarily powerful with grating passion, capitulating to the will of another. They will continually strive to destroy, moving rapidly while ruining everything they touch, leaving lifelessness in their wake. Such it is prudent to watch them for a duration of time. They're going to encircle Israel. That is really the consequence of nearing Israel at the waist. They're going to come from the Mediterranean, and they're going to come from Egypt. They're going to come up the Gulf of Aqaba. They're going to come across Saudi Arabia. They'll come down from Syria and then from Jordan. Did you all see the picture, the first picture ever of a black hole? Was released on Wednesday of this week.
Yeah. No, that was pretty cool.
And what did the black hole look like?
Out there,
ring of light.
A ring of reddish light that was trapped just outside the event horizon, such that the black hole itself was just dark. But there was this circular ring of high energy trapped outside of the event horizon, which was still viewable. So you couldn't see the black hole. What you saw was everything that surrounded the black hole. Well, that's going to be what's going to happen with Israel. It's going to be very dark. You're not going to be able to see it. It'll be surrounded on all sides, pressured on all sides. I just like that picture of that black hole. This is a desperate picture. This is a picture that is unimaginable. You know, in World War II, Dunkirk, where the Brits decided that they would go off and go across the channel, and you know they would have a spearhead on the other side to defend Great Britain and go after those Nazis, and they were all trapped.
Yeah,
and surrounded them.
Oh.
Yeah. That's what it's going to be like.
Horrible.
Except there'll be no flotilla of boats that comes to snatch them off, the survivors off the beach.
Mm-hmm.
They're surrounded on all sides. There'll be no hope. And then God himself will intervene. In the middle of that black hole, there will be light. And those who are in the event horizon will be trapped inside. But that is where we're headed. And we're headed there, well, quickly. You know, at this point, and I just want to go through some numbers here, and we can start another program without having to go through all these numbers. Go ahead, though, Kirk.
No, I was just thinking this is so tragic. Before we go, I did want to say something to the folks that listen, because so many of them, I think, are now translating themselves. That one of the things that you have done in this, and especially in 18, Yeshaya 18 when they get to the next chapter. This takes a lot of time, and I realize it's more so than just going to a lexicon and looking up this word and looking up this word, or going to three or four lexicons. You've taken the time, and the program I use, you can do this with it. You can go to every time you find a word, you can look up how it was used, and if you'll take the time to look it up, that's why your translations are rather large compared to what you would find in an ordinary translator. But they're also totally accurate. If you go back and say that is what it means. Now, you've stated several times that you will use, you'd rather throw all that in there and examine each one, which we should, to see what is appropriate. Sometimes some of it is, and sometimes it's negative when it's out of context with that. But for the most part, you need to examine all of those, and that's one way that you can absolutely do it, besides just going through the lexicons and looking up all the words and seeing what they said. So
there's really an interesting way to define words that has become part and parcel of what I'm trying to do now, but it causes these chapters to go from being 40 or 50 pages to 140 or 50 pages.
But
and that is to, if you want to define a word, if you want to know what it means, you really have to closely examine and carefully consider what Yahweh has to say about that word. I've gone back, and I'm in the process of completely rewriting chapter, I think it's 11, of volume 2. Yeah, it was the chapter on Moab, because Yahshua 15 and 16, this is 17 we're doing now, so we jumped ahead. 15 and 16 are two chapters entirely devoted to the condemnation and the ultimate prophetic destruction of Moab. And Yirmiyah 48, same thing. But the prophetic destruction of Moab is in Daniel. It's in many different places in the prophet Ezekiel.
Yeah.
And so I was confronted with, well, what in the heck does Moab represent, since Moab ceased to exist long before these prophecies about its ultimate destruction were written?
Yeah, they're gone. Yeah.
Yeah, it was gone. It wasn't a kingdom. There's nothing left of it.
No.
And so what does Moab represent? And you can spend all the time you want with the lexicons. And by the way, the lexicons aren't going to tell you what Moab is comprised of. But Moab is the same thing as Mikra. It's the same thing as Mishpat. That when there is a ma before a Hebrew term, the ma says to question it, to ponder the who, what, why, where, when of whatever follows. And so you can figure that part out and say, well, is Moab, Ab is the first word in the Hebrew lexicon, don't have to take too much time to figure out what it means. It means father.
Father. Yeah.
Father. And so Ma or Mo, Ab would be, who's your father? What's your father? How is this? What is the story with your father? Question your father, right? So you can do all of that, but how does that then help you understand what Moab represents today when Yahweh is exposing and condemning it? The answer is it doesn't.
No.
So you, to really appreciate these prophetic references, there's only one way you can translate them. And it isn't by looking at the words in the lexicon. It doesn't work. Sure, I can translate the words, but it doesn't explain what they mean. What you've got to do is use a concordance, which will tell you when the word was used, every time it was used. And you go right to the first time it was used. And then the second time it was used. And then the third. And let Yahweh define what the word means. So you know who it is that he is condemning in the last days. So that's the part that takes so much time, but it's so worthwhile. Because why do you think I started rewriting chapter 11 and it's Yahshua 15 and 16? And yet I've spent the last 2 weeks of my life translating the 19th chapter from beginning to end of Bava Sheet. It's the story of Lot and Sodom. Why in the world would you go to Lot and Sodom if you want to understand what Moab is?
Well, that's the child of Lot.
First time it's used.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Moab is Lot's son through his eldest daughter.
Mm-hmm.
And she tells us why she named him Moab.
Yeah. Yeah.
And Lot's whole experience explains what was going on that caused his daughters to get him drunk and to have sex with him such that they would give birth, the eldest would give birth to Moab. And then you realize after you've done all of this analysis of Sodom, that Yahweh tells you that Sodom is Moab. So if you want to understand, you got to go back through what he says, and it requires this enormous but tremendously rewarding investment of time. It's, you don't just translate now on these insanely important, well, not insanely, but tremendously important things. We were talking about in Yeshayah 18, he introduced a word that's very seldom used. Alaoma.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking to people. But he's got all sorts of words for people. Why did he choose Laom? Used 20 times. 22 times, I think. Why did he choose that one? Well, guess where the first time it's used? The first time it's used is the difference between Jacob and Esau.
Yeah.
The story tells you exactly what Laom means. And I think that is the next level, if you will, in translation, is translation by association. We've done it before, like Zeruah. We learned Edom. You know, we translated by association Torah. First time it's introduced. There's lots of words like that. But personally, I think that happens to be the most insightful, most fun way to now to translate, to understand what the words represent based upon how they've been used.
Well, the only reason I mention it, number one, I'm delighted that you explained it, because that's extremely helpful to those that are translating, but also it answers the question of people who read this and say, where the heck do you get all that out of that one word, out of phrases?
Yeah.
You know, and it's back to the credibility that you were talking about earlier during the show, is that can I trust you? Well, yeah, now go do your thing and do it the same, you know, do it the same way, and you'll find it there. And
Yeah. No. So, you know, and part of it too is that there are lots of things that are extrapolations. You know, Moab, I will have extrapolated the meaning of Moab based upon 2 months of research.
Mm-hmm.
Now, is there a possibility that after 2 months of considering what Yahweh has to say about it that I've misinterpreted something? Absolutely. That I missed something, that I've added something, maybe I shouldn't have added, that I'm a little too inclusive, a little not quite inclusive enough.
Well, certainly. On that point. Yeah, sure.
But you know, what I would say is, after several months of researching it and sharing with you everything I learned along the way, you've got a pretty good foundation, you know, to step out and say, all right, there's some credibility to this, and since it seems like it's interesting, I think I'm going to go see it if I can validate it, or if I can challenge it. And you'll be rewarded for doing so.
Yeah. I tell you, I'm impressed.
Oh, it's a stunning teacher. Wait till we get to, we'll turn back the clock to the chapters on Moab. The conversation, the story, and the way the story is told of the destruction of Sodom is so revealing. It is absolutely not the story we've all been led to believe. It's not about sexual deviance. There's some sexual deviance at the end of it.
Yeah.
But even that is specifically a function of giving birth to what we witness in the today that Moab represents.
What you just covered.
Yeah, but in Sodom, there's no indication in Sodom that the Sodomites were trying to rape the Moloch, or that Lot was offering his daughters up to be gang raped.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a story of sex. No sex going on in Sodom. And what the story really is and how it's presented, where Lot represents Israel, and Sodom represents the broken family of man. Oh, the story is just riveting. And then there's so many little things in it, like in the presentation, Lot uses three different Hebrew words for door. And he invites the Moloch in to celebrate unyeasted bread. How many times do you think he mentions door?
Three.
About seven.
That's a much better guess, yes.
Yeah.
And each time that he mentions door, it represents one of the Mikra. And he's there celebrating unyeasted bread, which is the Mikra that he really needs to be celebrating.
Yeah.
With the Moloch.
Yeah.
All that furor is going on outside.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just how the story is.
Riveting. Yeah, it's peanut. Isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, you know, the one thing that Lot said, that the townspeople could not do?
Coming through the door.
It wasn't that they couldn't rape the Moloch. It wasn't that they couldn't have their way with the Moloch. It's just one thing he told them that the townspeople they couldn't do. They couldn't speak to him.
Mm.
He precluded them from speaking to the Moloch.
Mm.
And have you ever read that in your King James?
No, of course not.
And then when you realize what he said and why he said it, then you have to ponder, why would he say that? And then when he's talking about his daughters, and he says they have not known a man, and it's lo yada, and every translation tries to say, you know, that they're virgins. Sorry, it's not what it says. Yahweh's got two Hebrew words that he uses to explain men and women having sexual relations. And it's either sakab, to lay with and have sex with, or bog, to come into. One of the two. Yada's not the word.
No.
And what it said is they were unfamiliar with men. They were ignorant of the ways of men. Well, the profound difference between being opposed to, being ignorant of the ways of man, and being a virgin. Instead of virgins.
Quite a difference.
Says, I want to use that my daughters as a way of making a contrast here. Now, look at them. They have chosen not to embrace the ways of man. So the whole story is so profoundly different than what we read in English Bibles. And we've created this term, a sodomite, to somebody that has either anal or oral sex based upon the depravity of the Christian interpretations of Sodom. And they'll say, you know, the world's like Sodom now because of sexual promiscuity. No. God did not destroy Sodom because of sexual promiscuity. He destroyed them because of their religion, their politics, their broken family values. That's why he destroyed them.
Yeah. He hates their feast. He hates their feast.
Yeah. It's the ways of man and man's fractured family. So it's just will have a bomb.
Everywhere you go, he says, he keeps saying that. I mean, what? Why didn't? I was looking at quickly. I know you got to go, but I was looking at Wormwood just because I was trying to look up. Well, okay, about the love story. And I was looking at all this, and I was reading Amos. You know, like it's 5:7, and I kept on reading and reading and reading, and the thing that was, I got this phrase, and I shared it with somebody yesterday. It's in 5:21, he says, "I hate, I despise your feast, your chag. I cannot stand the stench of your solemn assemblies." 2 verses later, I think it is. He says, "I take away from me the noise of your songs, and I will not listen to your music of your harps." If you think for a moment you can do this and then go down to the Easter, you know, pick up eggs.
You're hymnal and you're praising God. I'm sorry, you're not praising God and you're singing songs that you're hymnal. You're not listening.
No. I mean, how clear can you be?
Yeah. It's like, sorry, there's no amazing grace.
No, there's no amazing grace.
Rotia, crap.
That's good. Yeah. Yeah, in fact, all the way through the story of Lot, it's the story of no, there's no grace. No tolerance.
I'm anxious to read that.
Right.
Me too, yeah.
If I wasn't working from the inside out, I mean, I've rewritten the first like 35 pages of it, but I've got to tie the rest together, and then I've got to go to the end because I had all these definitions of Moab, which I think were pretty accurate,
mm-hmm.
but not properly justified.
Not complete.
Yeah, you know how. You know, I looked at Moab, and I came to the conclusion that Moab was multiculturalism, socialist secular humanism, Pauline Christianity, and those things are really blended together today.
Certainly are in the United States and Western Europe.
Yeah, and in Europe. Yeah, they're blended together. I mean, Islam is already gone, so we don't have to worry about Islam. But that's Europe and the United States. And to a large degree, it's even China now. Socialist secular humanism, multiculturalism, and Pauline Christianity. And so that's how I and I had a lot more to it. It's clearly Moab is the place where the Torah's voice died, and I was able to justify that and explain what that means, which is, I mean, it's and multiculturalism, and it's their moral code is completely opposed to the moral code of the Torah. Pauline Christianity is completely opposed to the Torah. And socialist secular humanism essentially replaces the God of the Torah with man. So those were the conclusions. But it's bigger than that. And it's hard to imagine something bigger than the blend of socialist secular humanism, multiculturalism, and Pauline Christianity. And I think that it does not include necessarily Roman Catholicism, because I think Roman Catholicism is Esau. And there are places where Esau is specifically mentioned in the Edom.
Yes. I agree there.
The whole process is...
Ain't this fun?
It's been extraordinarily enlightening. It's been enlightening for me at a time where I'm realizing this is the story of the fractured human family, and it's representing Lot represents Israel, Sodom represents Moab. Moab is the focus of these prophecies. Israel's return from being in a fractured family situation is essential for us to understand, and we all have fractured earthly families.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it's the way it brings all of it together is inspiring.
Great insight.
I sure think so, anyway.
Yeah, you heard Saint agree with Asher a few minutes ago. He was funny.
Yes, yeah. She's in there now chewing on a rawhide bone and having a good old time. I just mentioned her name, so I'm getting both eyeballs. I'm stopping. I'm no longer chewing on the bone. I'm giving you the stare down. I want to know why you called my name.
What, Dad?
Uh-huh. Where's my cookie?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. I said, we're going to get something to eat. What are we doing? What are we doing? Go for a walk?
Let's go.
Let's go. Yeah, walking with the dog. It's kind of all the dogs are just marvelous for giving us an impression of just what it means to be a companion.
Mm-hmm.
And the kind of playfulness and going for walks together and taking care of one another and the affection and all that sort of thing.
Yeah. Well.
All right, fellas. We'll have to decide after this. Do we go to the story of because there's not just the story of Lot and Sodom. There's also the story of the three kings destroying Moab, and that story is riveting too.
Mm-hmm.
And so we go back. Yeah, we go back to chapter. We go forward to chapter 18. I don't know.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, keep us posted so we can be a little bit prepared. I have hope my eyes will be back in about the middle of the week. I hope so. I can read.
Okay. I want you to have eyes back again.
Good luck with that.
Yeah, thank you very much, JB.
Thank you, and I apologize that you guys were dragged into the rubbish of the week.
That's all right. We're all family here.
Never mind.
Yeah. All right. Well, good deal, guys. God bless.
Shalom, shalom.
Okay. Shalom, shalom.
Bye-bye.
Happy Shabbat.
See you next week.
Next week, Pesach.
For Pesach.
Yep. Yeah. Good night.
All right. Night.